From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, as COVID-19 cases skyrocket, Michigan officials defend their efforts to bring the numbers under control.
The kinds of actions we are taking are the kinds of actions that public health departments have taken for decades in response to public health challenges like epidemics. Epidemics are not new, and responses like this are not new.
A conversation with MDHHS Chief Robert Gordon. Also, how Michigan's tribal nations won an important fight for voting rights.
Previously, they had been engaged in a series of wars to protect their lands and rights, but after losing these wars, they had to adjust very quickly, and part of that adjustment was citizenship.
And the election night slip that became the darling of conspiracy theorists.
This was just catnip for the people who were waiting for something like this in order to spread it around.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, many of us will be spending at least part of our Thanksgiving on Zoom, like so many other aspects of life in 2020. But that doesn't mean you have to spend your entire holiday dinner on a conference call.
The idea of like a Thanksgiving conference call is just torture. But I do think, you know, we like to check in with each other on holidays. So however you need to check in with your family, do that, whether it's the phone or Zoom. I think about like 5-10 minutes tops.
We'll talk with a writer at Bon Appetit about Thanksgiving etiquette during a pandemic. That's later in the show. But first, many of us are having a crazy year, but Robert Gordon's version of 2020 truly stands out. As head of Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services, he's had to manage epidemic orders, safety plans for schools, and a thousand other things that need attention because of COVID. Now Washington's calling. Gordon is going to be a co-leader on Joe Biden's transition team for the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. Director Gordon, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you are not able to talk about the work that you'll be doing for Joe Biden's transition team, but I did want to ask, can you tell us why you thought this was an important thing to be doing right now?
Yeah, it was a chance to share our experiences, successes, and challenges in Michigan with the response to COVID, and also to give policymakers in Washington a chance to better understand what states really need right now, including Michigan, first and foremost.
It feels like there's not a single aspect of Michigan DHHS's business that has not been affected by the pandemic. Is that true?
That is true, and is a challenge across the entire department.
So what are your top priorities at this stage?
Our highest priority is to encourage all Michiganders to cut back on indoor gatherings. We know that COVID spreads when people gather indoors with people from outside of their families, even friends, even loved ones. And on Sunday night, we issued an order that closed public settings where folks gather indoors. But just as important beyond the order is that each of us individually make a decision, even in our own homes, to cut back on those indoor gatherings outside the family. If we can all do that, it will be the most important thing to bring COVID back under control.
DHHS stepped in after Governor Whitmer's initial lockdown orders were challenged in court, and your department has been the engine that has been issuing guidance and, in some cases, outright rules for things like how people can congregate, how business can be done. I haven't been aware of any legal challenges, but has there been anything going on? Has the department met any legal resistance to its rules and guidance at this point?
Yeah, there's some lawsuits making their way through the courts. We are acting under a legal authority that the Michigan legislature gave to the governor years ago after the Spanish flu. And the kinds of actions we are taking are the kinds of actions that public health departments have taken for decades in response to public health challenges like epidemics. Epidemics are not new, and responses like this are not new.
How would you rate, generally speaking, Michigan's level of compliance among businesses and private citizens? We hear a lot about people who resist these rules, but what would you say is the general picture of whether Michiganders are complying?
I think we had incredible compliance in the spring, and it is the central reason that Michigan brought infections and deaths down to a greater degree, I believe, than any other state. I think as time has gone on, it has been more challenging here, as it's been more challenging everywhere. Everyone is exhausted. I will tell you, as you said, I personally and my family and my kids are exhausted. But this is like a 5-alarm fire for our state. Each of us personally has a chance to save lives. We have a chance to be like that fireman or firefighter who goes into the building and through our actions to save literally thousands of lives. It is not an exaggeration what the stakes are right now. So we are really asking everyone to step up.
Yeah. You mentioned the exhaustion and the fact that even your family is not immune to this. What are you telling your kids about sticking it out at this time?
I'm telling them to be forgiving of themselves, to be forgiving of me as a dad. I'm being a little more easygoing about Fortnite than I would be normally. And I'm telling them that this will end and we will get to the other side. And I think that they are learning about perseverance and contribution and sacrifice in ways that I think will help them, much as they are suffering and we are all suffering now, will help them be better, stronger people in the long run.
Director Gordon, we're at a stage right now where both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are hoping to get in front of federal regulators for approval and maybe get some doses out by the end of the year. At least one of these vaccines is going to be made in Michigan. Do you know what the distribution is going to be like and who might be first in line, whether Michigan's going to have a shot at some of those doses?
Yeah, we are working incredibly hard under Dr. Khaldun on a distribution plan for vaccines. It's going to need to be quite complicated. And in the end, we're going to need to make sure to get those vaccines out to the front lines in every part of the state, make sure that all communities are served. And to begin with, make sure that folks on the front lines who are at greatest risk, particularly healthcare workers, get those vaccines so that they can do their work safely.
Mm-hmm. Would you expect that places like assisted living and schools would be prioritized next before the public got doses? Or, I mean, we understand that the front line has to be healthcare workers, but who else is in the top tiers?
Yes, we of course worry immensely about the individuals who are most vulnerable, and those in particular are older individuals or individuals with medical conditions who are in congregate care settings. That has been a focus from the beginning, and getting vaccines to those kinds of people will be a focus going forward.
What can you tell us about Michigan's access to testing?
Michigan has done really well on access to testing. We have, I believe, currently more than 50,000 tests a day in Michigan. We are in the top 5 states nationally per capita. It was not like that initially. We had to work very hard to get testing up, and we did. And it was a team effort, not just the state, but hospitals, universities, community health centers around the state, working together with faith-based leaders, with local doctor's offices, with urgent cares, with pharmacies. We have really expanded greatly access to testing. We continue to have a challenge with turnaround times, but you know, that is something where we are actually, compared to a lot of states, doing relatively well.
Are there other aspects of DHHS's business, maybe what's going on in Michigan's hospitals, that are still keeping you awake at night?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that keep me awake at night. Contact tracing is really struggling right now because of the number of cases. We are working hard to prioritize the cases that matter most. I guess one thing I want to say is the work that local public health departments are doing and the work that department staff are doing right now is just extraordinary. There are hundreds or thousands of people across Michigan. You don't know their names. They are working around the clock and saving lives. And I personally just feel enormous honor and sense of respect as I work alongside all of those folks.
We get the sense, talking to especially health departments, maybe in the UP or smaller towns, that mandates and rules carry a bit less weight than they might in places like Detroit or Oakland County or Grand Rapids or Ann Arbor. Are there ways in which DHHS has modified its messaging as well?
Yeah, I think we want to speak to people in language that resonates with them. We have changed our communications. For example, we did a public service announcement not long ago where the featured speakers were all veterans and they were all putting on masks with American flags on them, and they were talking about how this was a form of service, just like the service thing, not just like, but it was a form of service to our country and to their community. And I personally deeply believe that. I will say, when it comes to the question of requirements, there's a lot of evidence on this at this point. If you look at places in the United States or elsewhere that have not responded with public action, they have not been able to get the virus under control. And you're seeing that in states right now, and it is tragic. And if you look at Western Europe, where they had growth very similar to ours, those countries responded, much as Michigan did, Governor Whitmer did on Sunday night, not with a lockdown, but with targeted and temporary measures. And those states, those countries have seen a turn. It's not to say it's over, but they have seen a turn. And because of what they did, they are closer to being able to reopen safely, as opposed to feeling that they are in an endless dark tunnel. So it's getting out of that tunnel is the reason that we are doing what we're doing.
You know, at the same time, there are people in many places in Michigan who have lost loved ones to COVID and who are dealing with all the realities of the disease in this year, who look at the public face of Michigan's response, and they're very frustrated, and they can't understand, you know, they can't understand why there isn't some sort of mandate or whether there's some way that they can get through to people. How do you hold the two realities of Michigan's COVID experience in your head at the same time?
It's a really hard question. I think we obviously try to remember, I'm someone who thinks and talks a lot in terms of numbers, but I try always to remember that behind every number is a name and a human being. Every lost life was a unique life. It was a sacred life. It was someone's loved one. And in our everyday work outside of times like this, we think of ourselves. And in our everyday lives, not just as the health department, but all of us, we would say if we had the opportunity to save one life, that would be an extraordinary privilege and responsibility. And we are at a moment when we as a society have an opportunity to save thousands of lives. And so to think of both the opportunity and responsibility that that entails is a very great burden, but it also is inspiring, because it is a moment when we all can act and we all can make an incredible difference. And so I try to focus on that every day, and I hope that all of us will.
Robert Gordon is director of Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services. Director Gordon, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll continue the conversation about Michigan's role in producing potential COVID-19 vaccines.
They're going to be packing it in dry ice, and the facilities that receive the vaccines are going to need the capability of being able to store the vaccines in those extremely cold temperatures.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Two COVID vaccines may be nearing the finish line. Moderna and its competitor Pfizer recently announced preliminary results showing that their vaccines appear to be strongly effective. Some of these trials have been conducted in Michigan, and we know that Pfizer's vaccine could be produced here if it eventually goes to market. What kind of infrastructure is going to be needed for that, and where will the vaccine go first? Karen Bouffard is a health reporter at the Detroit News. We're hoping she can clear up some of this for us. Karen, hi, what are you hearing?
Hello. Well, there's a lot of infrastructure that's going to be required for this. And the Operation Warp Speed at the federal level is working on putting all of that together. And the companies that are manufacturing the vaccines are also working on putting together those details. I think that the infrastructure that's required is going to depend on which vaccine we're talking about. The Pfizer vaccine has a few complications in that it needs to be stored at ultra-cold temperatures. This would be about minus 112 degrees Fahrenheit. So this requires extremely cold temperatures and in special freezers.
Is that more of an issue in the production process or in terms of the storage and logistical issues of getting it out to hospitals and clinics?
Well, the temperature is part of the storage issue, but it's also part of the distribution issue. For example, the Pfizer vaccine has to be kept at these low temperatures during the distribution process. So they're going to be packing it in dry ice, and the facilities that receive the vaccines are going to need the capability of being able to store the vaccines in those extremely cold temperatures while they're waiting to be injected into people. The Moderna vaccine, although it is similar in that it's an mRNA-based vaccine, can be stored at normal refrigerator temperatures. And it also has a longer shelf life. You can thaw the Moderna vaccine and store it in a normal refrigerator for about 30 days, and it can even be stored at room temperature up to about 12 hours, whereas the Pfizer vaccine has to be kept at these really cold temperatures until it's ready to be used. So they both are similar, but I think that in terms of distribution, the Moderna vaccine is going to be a little bit easier to distribute because of this temperature issue.
Karen, you write that the Pfizer vaccine, the company is projecting trying to produce 1.3 billion doses next year at two places, its Kalamazoo manufacturing operation and a plant in Belgium that will provide the European supply. Do you have any sense of where the balance of production is going to be? Is it pretty much evenly split? Can you tell?
I'm not sure because I'm not sure the number of doses that will be needed in Europe as opposed to the United States. That would be an issue of population, and I don't have those numbers handy. However, I can tell you that the Kalamazoo plant is going to be producing all of the vaccine for U.S. consumption, and the European facility is going to be producing the vaccine for Europe.
Do you know if Pfizer is going to have to radically expand its facilities to get this done?
Well, it's already been expanding the facility in Kalamazoo. I believe it was about nearly $90 million that it invested already this year, early in the year, when they started working on a vaccine as early as the beginning of January. So they've actually been designing and manufacturing some of their own equipment. And they installed a freezer farm on that Kalamazoo property with 350 ultra cold freezers. So they've had to develop all kinds of new technologies for the storage and manufacture of their vaccine.
Karen Bouffard is a HealthBeat reporter at the Detroit News. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you, April. It was my pleasure.
As Native people in Michigan were exercising their rights to vote this month, they were also taking part in a unique piece of Michigan history. This was one of the first states to negotiate citizenship with Native people. Eric Hemingway is director of archives and records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. He's also a member of the Michigan Historical Commission. Eric, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
So, state citizenship was on the table for Native people starting in 1850. Can you set a little context for us about what was going on at the time? I mean, this was at a point when a lot of tribes had already been forced to concede a great many land rights, correct?
Yes, and I'm glad you asked about context because it's really critical to understanding why tribes were going for state citizenship at this specific time period. And leading up to the 1850 Michigan Constitution, the states have been engaged in a series of treaties with the federal government. All the tribes throughout Michigan were signing various treaties, ceding millions of acres of land, and they were trying to reserve a land base, a home base in their homelands with these treaties, and also to retain rights to natural resources and to obtain goods. And so the treaties were being negotiated at this time, but there was also in the previous decades, Indian removal that had been sweeping through the eastern part of the United States. And while most of the focus on Indian removal has been in the southeast with the Cherokees and the Choctaws and the five civilized tribes, removal was occurring in the Great Lakes, and it was occurring here in Michigan, where Potawatomis were being hunted and removed to Kansas. So it was coming north, and the tribes seen this, and they were taking every step to avoid removal. Removal is just a very brutal piece of American and Native history where tribes were hunted and forced to march out to Oklahoma and Kansas, and many tribal members died from just the journey itself, from exposure, starvation,
right,
sickness, and then they were forced to live in this alien environment on the plains. And tribes were doing everything in their power to avoid this.
Yeah. What was the thinking among the Odawa and Ojibwe leaders and some of the other Anishinaabe about why citizenship might help to shield them in some sense?
Well, if they were realizing very quickly that they had to adapt to American culture and society as being forced upon them with civilization policies that were being enacted by the federal government, and they seen that they had to reevaluate not just themselves and their communities, but their relationships with the federal and state governments. Previously, they had been engaged in a series of wars to protect their lands and rights, but after losing these wars, they had to adjust very quickly, and part of that adjustment was citizenship. If they could obtain citizenship, they would have a more equal footing. I'm not going to say it was completely equal because it wasn't, but a more equal footing in courts with government-to-government relationships and also their neighbors.
So what was in it for the settler state government to agree to negotiate this? I mean, did they realize what was at stake here?
Well, there was not consensus with the states having citizenship, and the tribes were pushing for this immediately. I know more about the Odawa, obviously, because I work with the Odawa community and have grew up in an Odawa community. And we had leaders as early as the 1820s recognize the need for citizenship, and they started to write petitions. They started to write letters to the state government and to the federal government for state and federal citizenship. And we had a very close ally with one of the priests here at Little Traverse, Harbor Springs, Father Piez, and he would work with our community on trying to obtain state citizenship, largely to protect lands. So it wasn't a consensus push by the state to see this, but it was a consensus push by the tribes.
Was it controversial within the emerging Michigan government, which was going through a constitutional convention at that time? Was it controversial to have the idea of citizens that were also part of individual nations within the state?
Absolutely. And there was this blatant discrimination and racism against tribes during this time period. And it reflects in the Constitution of 1850 in and of itself, where it says that a tribe to obtain citizenship has to, one, renounce their tribal citizenship, their tribal identity, and two, demonstrate that they are civilized. I still to this day don't know the matrix or the formula for proving that you are civilized, but that's written into the Constitution. So tribes had to prove this civilization and then at the same time renounce their tribal identity. So just that type of wording to me shows that it was controversial because tribes were being labeled savages, heathens, pagans, at this time, unequals in society and in government. So to have this population seen as unequal obtain citizenship, without a doubt, would have been controversial in some populations.
So when state citizenship was achieved, how did it end up affecting the lives of Native people?
Well, statehood being achieved in, I believe, 1837, this opened up the tribal lands to white settlers. So before this, it was a territory, and it was not as settled. There wasn't as many American settlers coming in, but once you have statehood, you have to have a certain population, and then it opens it up to more population. So on the ground level, April, you're having people compete for resources of land, food, water. This is day-to-day living where people are going hungry. They have to relocate their villages and their communities. So it had a huge impact on every single community and every single Native individual.
Once the state of Michigan did start to offer citizenship to Native people, what was the net effect on people's lives? Did it have the impact that the Anishinaabe negotiators had hoped for?
Well, I think yes and no. I don't think there's a clear-cut answer to this. This 1850 Constitution is right in the middle of a very contentious time for the tribe, particularly the Odawa in northern Michigan. We signed a major treaty in 1836. Ceding 16 million of acres of land to the United States to stay in northern Michigan, but removal was still a threat. We still were being threatened with removal in 1837, 1838, and we had to sign another treaty in 1855 to remove the threat of removal. So this Constitution is right in that time period of great uncertainty. It's unreal for me to think of this time period where the army would come and remove you by force. So they're taking all these steps to avoid that. And this is part of that, of being civilized, being a citizen, you know, farming, doing what the government is asking you to do just to stay home. So there's a lot of moving parts that are going into this time period, especially in 1850.
Do you think that in hindsight, it did remove some of the risk that people were worried about removal?
I think it did to some degree. I think every step that the tribes took to stay home worked, because we're still here for the most part. They were demonstrating that we are equals in the sense of having, of being citizens. And they were enacting their own government, their agency of, you know, meeting and writing these letters and petitions. So I think it did work to some degree, but this also was this, you know, larger progress towards federal citizenship. So they're taking all these steps, not just for state citizenship, but federal citizenship. And tribes across the country wouldn't achieve U.S. citizenship until 1924. We were the last population to get U.S. citizenship.
Now, see, this is interesting because the Dawes Act, a piece of legislation that was both very influential and kind of infamous in Native circles, the Dawes Act, among other things, offered citizenship to people who accepted the way that the U.S. government was dividing Native lands. What else was going on that sort of slowed the process down?
Well, for instance, I mean, just the fact that Natives aren't being recognized as equals. So when Native people would come to, you know, your local governments or even state governments, they were still just being seen as savages. And some government officials, some local officials just weren't going to have a conversation with a savage. It was beneath them. It wasn't worth their time. And there was this idea that all Natives should be removed just out of the close proximity of white settlers. So that's working against us. And then there's the idea that Natives don't have an inherent right to their lands. And this is this idea of manifest destiny, that Natives have the right to possess land, but they don't have the right to own it. So that's working against us. So there's these large oppressions that are in every Native community, including ours here in Northern Michigan. And then you're trying to work against this. You're going against this tide of adopting this foreign government policy of citizenship. And so you're taking on this foreign government's idea of citizenship so you can use that to fight for your rights of owning land, of taking people to court, just being equals in your homelands.
It must have been a very, very hard sell for a lot of Native people who really did have a sense of their and knew the importance of their own sovereignty.
Absolutely. You're walking in two worlds. That's a saying that's used commonly in Indian country, where you're walking in your tribal world, but you have to walk in this American world at the same time. So they're straddling, you know, these cultural and governmental and societal differences. At one point, you're retaining your nativeness, but then at the same time, you have to take on this Americanness to stay home. And it all comes back to home. That's what we're trying to do. And we're really fortunate here in Northern Michigan, the Odawa at Little Traverse. We're in our homelands, the same homelands when Columbus landed. So not many tribes can say, you know, we're in the same homelands upon contact. But the Odawa at Wauganuxing at Little Traverse can say that. A lot of this is due to good leadership, strategic leadership, adjusting very quickly, day to day sometimes, of trying to, you know, navigate these stormy waters of state government, federal governments, white settlers, missionaries, and priests coming into your areas and trying to convert you and change you. But they knew that citizenship was key to voting and to having your voice heard. They knew this immediately. And so they acted to have their voice heard.
It sounds like none of this would have happened if it hadn't been the advocacy in the Little Traverse Bay Band and elsewhere to talk about citizenship in that way.
Yeah, every tribe knew this, and they were at different levels of, you know, their own governments and their own agency. I just speak strongly from Little Traverse because that's where I'm at and where I'm from, but other tribes were doing the same thing. It's hard to relate to people how quickly the change was happening. In 1850, you're pushing for state citizenship, but only 40 years earlier, the men in your community are fighting the United States in the War of 1812 to try to keep them out of Michigan. So within one generation, you have this massive shift in your communities of taking up arms against this one country, and then you're trying to become citizens of that same country. This all happens in some people's lifetimes. So it happens really quickly, and they are, like I said, adjusting year to year, sometimes day to day. Tribes, they take this seriously, and I just was reading an article about the recent presidential election where Arizona, the tribal population, had a big influence on the outcome of that state, where a large population of primarily Navajos came out and voted. And this happened in Minnesota and Wisconsin as well, where there was very close in the presidential election and the tribes came out and they voted. So their voices were being heard. And it's all because of their ancestors making sure they had taken the steps so their voice would be heard.
Eric Hemingway is director of archives and records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Eric, it's good talking to you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you very much.
Up next, holiday gatherings. They're going to be different this year, and that's okay.
You know what, Mom and Dad? We don't want to kill you, so we're going to stay home this year. Maybe we'll drop a pie off, have a beer in the backyard, but we love you so much, we can't put you at risk.
Pandemic holiday etiquette. That's in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's talk about how strange this Thanksgiving's going to be. If you've been struggling to decide on that large family gathering, please keep in mind health officials are warning it's not the best idea, as COVID cases are on the rise. Thinking about bringing up the presidential election? Good luck with that one. So what are the do's and don'ts this Thanksgiving? Our next guest will try to have some answers for you. Alex Beggs is a senior staff writer for Bon Appetit magazine. She's hanging her hat in Michigan these days. Alex Beggs, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, can I just start by asking, what are your plans for Thanksgiving this year? Have you had to have that conversation with your family?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, and the entire country knows, that Michigan cases are really high right now. And finally, last week, we had to tell my partner's parents that, you know what, Mom and Dad, we don't want to kill you. So we're gonna stay home this year. Maybe we'll drop a pie off, have a beer in the backyard. But we love you so much, we can't put you at risk. And it went over just perfectly fine. So I'm staying home. I'm deciding the menu now. It's going to be non-turkey.
What?
I don't think it's that shocking that people don't really like turkey, but I think especially when you have the freedom to kind of do whatever you want, I'm trying to play with, like, what would I have at a restaurant that I would never make at home, like duck confit or some lobster pasta something. I don't know. It's got to feel fancy and awesome.
What aspects of the Michigan food scene have you been able to write about since you've been back?
So I've been coming to Michigan at least once or twice a year for the past, oh my God, maybe a decade, because my partner is from Traverse City. So throughout the years, I've written about stuff here and there. Since we've moved, I've written about Jet's Pizza, which I got a lot of DMs from Michiganders who I guess felt seen and heard. That was funny.
You very correctly identified it as perfect, so thank you for that.
Yeah, not really too controversial, but, you know, I had a piece planned for a summer issue of Bon Appetit, a travel story to Southwest Michigan starring Grainer Farms, which is just this, like, really fairy tale, special, magical place. And because of COVID, we had to scrap the story. I mean, it was this dinner series around communal tables. It was everything, you know, that we can't do. And that was heartbreaking. I really wanted to share that story. And yeah, I have such a long list of Michigan food things to say. My map is full of green flags of, like, places I want to go still.
Well, let's get to the main event. You write this monthly etiquette column for Bon Appetit called Is It Ever
Questionable?
Right.
Questionable etiquette.
Questionable etiquette column where you're answering readers' questions about table manners and all kinds of other related things. First off, this question, is it ever okay? Generally speaking, is the answer to that question yes or no?
If you're asking, it's probably no.
You have to ask.
People are asking me for like permission to do these things that they know are like slightly shameful. And sometimes I'm fine with it.
I don't think anybody imagined a Thanksgiving in lockdown, and you've had to tackle all kinds of strange questions. I saw one of your readers asked, "What if we just skip Thanksgiving this year? What can we do instead?" My gosh, is it ever okay just to skip Thanksgiving?
I don't see why not. I think that could take many forms, whether you're just not cooking turkey. You do whatever feels right to you. I think as long as you're playing the Charlie Brown soundtrack, it'll feel festive.
But, nice.
I think there are some people who are holiday people and they get really hype about Thanksgiving and the holidays, and others maybe it brings them down a little bit. So if this is the year that you are going to take a long, sad walk, maybe that's how you're going to celebrate this year. I think it's just important that you make it a Thanksgiving to remember, but not because you infected your entire extended family.
Right. I mean, maybe the thing to do is just sit with whatever we're feeling.
That's really deep, April.
Thank you.
Yes. Or just like watch all of the John Wick movies. I don't know.
Right. That's good.
You could do either.
Also acceptable. Well, okay. Another reader asks, how do I avoid a Thanksgiving Zoom? Can you give us some credible excuses for the dodge?
Oh my God. I'm so glad I don't have a Zoom family. The idea of like a Thanksgiving conference call is just torture. But I do think, you know, we like to check in with each other on holidays. So however you need to check in with your family, do that, whether it's the phone or Zoom. I think got like 5-10 minutes tops. I just think it's kind of like, what are you cooking? What are you doing? Okay, love you, bye. But along like having the entire meal digitally, everyone's yelling out over each other. I can't imagine that's fun for anyone.
So how do we credibly bow out? Can you just say, oh, I'm feeling a little stuffy, or
I'm all about the white lie. I got a pie in the oven. Oh, I've got so much going on. I've got to cook, you know. Oh, there's a package at the door. Whatever you have to do, get out of it.
I do wonder, you know, you said that you're not going to be doing traditional feasts this year, and what you had planned sounded pretty good, but there are always these food guides that go around claiming to know what is the most popular side dish for each state. I mean, green bean casserole tends to get a lot of likes in Michigan, but you can't really just roll out sweet potatoes, or I guess just even plain mashed. I mean, what says Michigan Thanksgiving to you?
I do like a green bean casserole. I think I'm definitely at, you know, whatever weird thing we do as a main, we're making green bean casserole because it's my favorite. And Bon Appetit, no, you know, I'm a little biased, but our green bean casserole is awesome. You make kind of a homemade cream of mushroom soup. You still get to use the French's crispy onions on top, so like don't worry about that part. Use fresh green beans, and I think, you know, Michigan produce is so awesome. I think anything that kind of highlights Michigan produce is a good Michigan side for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's good. Do you have a policy on like distance potlucks where family members each make part of the dinner and then leave portions for each other on the porch? I mean, is that?
I think we're definitely going to be dropping off a pie. And I love doing this thing with friends where I make too much food and then just have them bring containers over and take it. So we might do a little like leftover exchange. It's going to be cold, you know? So I know some people having Thanksgiving in their family's garage with space heaters. It's just like still a little too risky to me. I can't imagine we have the same sanitary protocols as, you know, restaurants and hospitals. But, you know, they say like open air gatherings are fine. So I think that that's definitely a thing you could do if you have the amount of space heaters necessary to do that in Michigan. I think that stuff is within the realm of safe.
Right. I mean, which do you
I'm no doctor.
No. It's, I mean, everybody's kind of just learning as we go. Do you think, just from the cook's perspective, is it more challenging to pull off the feast with the crowd? Or maybe scaling back, there are going to be a lot of people trying to do that massive multi-course dinner for like a household of two or three or four. I mean, I noticed in our corner of Michigan, the petite turkeys were just like gone. They were gone. And it's a reminder there are a lot of people doing the smaller table this year.
I think that's a good sign. Mm. I think the idea of feeding that many people just is too much work, and I don't think the payoff is good. I think you can tell your family you love them in the biggest way by not celebrating in such a large situation this year. So mm-hmm. yeah, it doesn't sound fun to me.
I know what you're saying, that everything can be pretty intense right now, but I got to say, the thing that's preoccupying me most is as we Zoom with family members, often I find myself asking people how they're doing, and they say, oh, fine. I'm fine, which is very 2020, but I'm 100% sure it's also not true. As the questionable etiquette columnist, what do you say to a friend or someone to draw them out when it seems like they may have a little bit more going on?
Well, some people want to talk about it and some don't. So I'm wary to say, fine, but like, you know, for a friend of mine who is a school teacher with two kids at home out of school right now, who's juggling both, like, I know she's not fine. And if she wants to talk about it, maybe I'll leave some openings there, but I'm also, you know, not going to pry. But I think if you're close to people and you can sense that they're not fine, I think even in a jokey way, being like, are you sure? You definitely don't seem fine. You know, just like kind of over the top, acknowledging it kind of maybe eases the tension a little bit and people can talk. But yeah, the word fine, that's a hard, that's, it's just because I think people keep in perspective, I'm healthy, I'm relatively good, compare, you know, things could be worse, or the ways we think. And sometimes you just need to acknowledge that, you're not in a good place.
Yeah.
And maybe the people in your life can bring you out of it. Wow, getting a little emotional for me.
You wrote an essay recently that I loved about cleaning. With my all-time favorite quarantine title, What If Barkeeper's Friend Is My Only Friend? That was just much, much, much too soon, by the way, for that title.
Oh, man.
How clean is your place right now?
Not very. And in fact, I got so overzealous with the barkeeper's friend that I've ruined multiple pots. So it kind of backfired on me a little bit. But the cleaning is, you know, can be such a stand-in for, you know, getting out something that you need to get out, or that immediate shiny result is so cathartic, and maybe that's what you need kind of in the middle of the day. I've definitely broken up the workday by scrubbing things. I don't know mm-hmm. if this is something I need to talk to a therapist about, but love barkeeper's friends, very satisfying. And just make sure you don't leave it on for longer than a minute, or you will scratch your pants like I did.
Yeah, bad things happen. What does a senior staff writer for Bon Appetit hit when she's stress baking?
Maybe stress baking is now just my normal state of baking. Yeah. But I love anything in a pudding in a jiggly category. Those are my favorite. So mm-hmm. yeah, flan, pudding, rice pudding. I'm very excited about, you know, holiday cookies. I made a great one from Claire Saffitz's Dessert Person. These pecan brittle oatmeal cookies, very elaborate, worth every laborious step along the way. I could talk about baking all day. I'll stop.
Alex Beggs is a senior staff writer for Bon Appetit. Her column, Questionable Etiquette Advice, is called Is It Ever Okay? And you can find it in the mag and also online. Alex, it's great to talk to you. Hang in there, and thanks for the tips.
You too, April. Thanks for having me.
Today's the deadline for Michigan's counties to certify their election results. It's a day of procedure that should go by with very little fanfare. Nothing about this year has been typical. Like a few weeks ago, when a seasoned northern Michigan clerk in Antrim County made a very human mistake. She didn't properly update some software, which meant the first results her county posted were wrong and needed to be corrected. Conspiracy theorists immediately used the error to undermine the legitimacy of the election in Michigan. Kay LaFond reports.
In early October, Antrim County Clerk Cheryl Guy reordered the ballots for one of her precincts. A candidate for trustee in the village of Mancelona needed to be added to the ticket before the upcoming election.
We put his name on the ballot, corrected them, and reordered.
Guy then updated her election reporting software just for the Mantalona precinct, and she thought she was done.
So that was the start of the problem, because...
Flash forward to the day after the election.
So we were scurrying. It was, you know, 4 a.m. I think we left here probably about a quarter to five.
Just a few hours after reporting Antrim County's results, Guy got an email letting her know that they seemed skewed. Joe Biden was the reported winner of the presidential race in a county that, historically, has been firmly red. Guy hadn't realized when she updated the election software weeks earlier that she needed to update it for all 16 precincts in her county, not just the one with the ballot change. The result of that incomplete update? A few thousand votes cast and tallied for Donald Trump were misreported as Biden votes.
What was missed, you know, is on us. And, you know, we're just gonna, well, this will never happen to us again.
Yeah.
Guy, who is an elected Republican, worked quickly to correct the error. But the story of a red county turning unusually blue was given a life of its own. Conspiracy theories about voting software being broadly unreliable or favoring Democrats were retweeted by high-profile Twitter accounts like Donald Trump Jr.'s. Laura Cox, chair of the Michigan GOP, said without evidence that other counties across the state could be susceptible to a software malfunction. By Friday, the Republican National Committee was using Antrim County to undermine the integrity of the election.
This was just catnip for the people who were waiting for something like this in order to spread it around.
That's Emily Dreyfus, a senior editor and fellow with Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. She says it was inevitable that Guy's error would be used in this way.
There was going to be, in the weeks before the election, everyone was on high alert saying there will be errors on election day. And these are the things that will be exploited by people who are looking for evidence to verify and further the agenda that they've already set up.
Dreyfus says if the conspiracy theory didn't target Antrim County, it would have targeted another place.
It is following up on the groundwork that Trump and the GOP had been laying to sow doubt in election integrity and in voting integrity for months. So it's like it's all part of this much larger campaign to get people to doubt the credibility of this election.
Researchers say a lack of knowledge, for example, about polling procedures, leaves people more vulnerable to disinformation in the first place. But it's hard to counter disinformation with knowledge after it's already out there. To try to deal with the confusion, the Michigan Secretary of State's office issued a press release corroborating Cheryl Guy's account of a user error. It said the incident was isolated and that a widespread error would be caught during county canvasses anyways. But none of that seemed to make a difference, which, according to Dreyfus, is kind of the point of disinformation campaigns.
You know, if she's the person who made the mistake, she also fixed it, and now the vote is secure. Yeah. But it's almost irrelevant to the people who will now never believe that it was secure.
In the days since the election, the Antrim Clerk's Office has received messages insinuating the staff are frauds or crooks. Victoria Rubin, a media researcher at the University of Western Ontario, points out the phenomenon of cascading logic, a strategy conspiracy theorists use to discredit fact checks. It basically means dismissing any new evidence debunking the conspiracy theory as part of the cover-up. Rubin says confirmation bias, or the tendency of the human mind to interpret new information as confirmation of existing beliefs, plays a big role here.
People are rushing to conclusions, and what do they have to rely on? They usually start thinking, well, what do I know to be true?
And she says if people's untrue beliefs are associated with an emotion, that makes them hard to unseat with facts. Cheryl Guy in Antrim County says she's upset at the questioning of the election's integrity.
And it's too bad that, you know, we're under a microscope because of this incident, and my fellow clerks are also.
And Guy says she's disappointed in Donald Trump's role in this as a leader.
And that's exactly it. You know, you have good losers and bad losers. You have good supporters and bad supporters, and you have people who just won't accept, you know, the numbers. And
she hopes people will eventually realize that Antrim County has nothing to hide. I'm Kay, LaFond.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.